In the heart of Silicon Valley is a sun-drenched town called Palo Alto. Once a dusty frontier town, it's become one of the wealthiest postcodes on the planet, alongside places like Luxembourg and Macau. It's acquired a kind of mythical reputation, a promised land for radical innovators and tech entrepreneurs, like, well, for example, Mark Zuckerberg. But it's not all it seems. Now, my next guest grew up in this intriguing corner of California. He describes Palo Alto as a city that's haunted by a long and unspoken history of exploitation and profiteering, which continues to propel us into a perilous 21st century. Malcolm Harris is a freelance journalist and author. His new book is called Palo Alto, A History of California, Capitalism and the World. Malcolm, welcome. You spent half your childhood living here. Well, what's it like?
It's a really nice place. It's sunny 300 days a year. The people there are really well educated, tend to be very wealthy. They have high expectations for the children. And at the same time, people report consistently over, as my research shows, the entire 160-year history of this place, that it's pretty creepy at the same time.
I understand the population's around 70,000.
Yeah, it's not a huge place, but its significance both to the economy and to world politics is really outsized.
And as you're about to point out to us, it's the story of America, from indigenous dispossession to the emergence of the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, when I started this project, it was in the midst of a lot of American historians sort of rewriting the history of the country and looking at the 1870s in particular as a time when the country is relaunched into the world and is reborn for the first time. And California isn't always told as part of that history, but it really ends up being central, I think. And Palo Alto comes out of that same time period of that 1870s. And so if American history starts again in the 1870s, Palo Alto is a really important place in that history.
Now, the Ohlone, the indigenous people of the lands, were the first victims of, well, early Californian capitalism, weren't they?
Yeah, and it's important for people to understand that there were still tens of thousands of indigenous people living in California, living as indigenous people in California, in Alta California, when Anglo-Americans came and colonized the place. We tell, those of us who grew up in California, told a history that blamed Spanish colonization for the eradication of indigenous people in Alta California. But that isn't really the history. The history involves really brutal acts of genocide that happened in the second half of the 19th century by Anglo-American colonizers in Alta California.
Tell me about Governor Peter Burnett.
This is the first governor of the state once it's admitted to the Union. And he basically makes this determination that rather than sign and ratify treaties with indigenous tribes, that they were in a position to eradicate them instead, to push them off their land entirely. And as a result, California still has no ratified treaties with any tribes.
So on their newly stolen lands, white people plant, well, a variety of crops and use slaves to work it.
Well, they enslave indigenous people, yeah, despite there being a ban on slavery in California as a state, since it comes in as part of the Union during the Civil War, American Civil War. So slavery, chattel slavery is banned in the state, and yet still capitalists find ways to enslave and then make workers dependent upon them. They find ways to create wage slavery in this territory.
Genocide is an oft-disputed term, but it's applicable here in that California's settlers had destroyed 80% of the native population by 1870.
Yeah, there's a scholar named Benjamin Madley whose book American Genocide, which is pretty recent, really chronicles this at a pretty granular level. And it's a history that people in America don't know, never mind people throughout the world, but people in the United States don't know. People in California don't know this history.
Talking about exploited labor, let's talk about the Chinese, because America's Transcontinental Railroad, connecting East and West, finished in 1869, has to be one of the world's great engineering feats, spruiked as a boon for California, but it relied on the exploited Chinese worker.
Absolutely. And it's important to understand the Chinese workers in California working on the Transcontinental Railroad were not what we think of, might think of as coolies. They were not enslaved. They got what was a decent wage for the time. But it was important that they be brought in by the railroad company, by the Central Pacific, and what became known as the Combine, because they were very capable workers. They're extraordinarily capable builders. There is a tradition of building work in China. There was high unemployment, so you had desperate workers who were looking for somewhere to go, and the railroad needed people who didn't have knowledge of the land and were going to be dependent on their employer. And so there was a match between these groups. But it's important to understand that they were not enslaved workers, but they were wage workers.
Nonetheless, many hundreds died in building the railroad. And the president of Central Pacific, Leland Stanford, who we'll hear more about later, was what? Technically an abolitionist, but only too ready to exploit cheap labor.
Yeah, and he really gets credit in the public mind for this importation of Chinese labor to finish the railroad, which the white settlers in the territory did not take kindly to because they saw it as a threat to their labor market position. And indeed it was in some ways, because once the railroad was finished, then these workers were moving into productive work in shoes, in cigars, in textiles. And white workers felt very threatened and blamed Leland Stanford personally because he was really the front man for this project. And it's out of that tensions, out of those tensions, that the Palo Alto, the suburb of Palo Alto, gets created in the first place.
I'm sure you're well aware of Australia's terrible history with Chinese labor, which led to riots and finally to the White Australia policy. But okay, into the 20th century, California's natural assets are being financialized and commodified. Enter an Italian-American banker. Tell me about him.
Yeah, you're talking about A.P. Giannini. And he's, as a young man, a very entrepreneurial young man, founds what he calls the Bank of Italy. And this is a bank that is devoted to gathering the deposits of local Italian immigrants throughout California and making those deposits available to people like him, you know, entrepreneurs, people who are looking to build up California. And he's very, very successful at this. And
but he was the classic, you know, self-made man. He works in fruit and vegetable distribution and forms relationships with farmers to nudge them towards, more profitable planting decisions.
Absolutely. The Bank of Italy becomes this crucial institution for the agricultural industry in California, not only providing loans, but actually creating the cartels and the organizations that were able to keep prices up for these commodities. So whether that's the raisin cartel or the apricot cartel, the bank is playing a really crucial role financing and organizing these associations.
I knew something of his history, but I had no idea that he was one of the financiers for the presidential election of FDR.
Absolutely. He was a big supporter of Roosevelt, big supporter of the Walt Disney Corporation, the big the early movie industry starts out in San Francisco, thanks to the Bank of Italy. But people know the bank, of course, now by a different name, which is the Bank of America.
It's interesting that even Karl Marx noted, was fascinated with what was going on in California.
Right. We don't think of Marx and California as being around at the same time. We think of them as distinct historical phenomenon occupying different centuries. But that wasn't the case. Marx was well aware of these early economic developments in California and sought out more information, and as well as understood the implications for what planetary capitalism would mean, and that capitalism would have room to grow in California.
He said nowhere else has the upheaval most shamelessly caused by capitalist centralization taken place with such speed. From the banks to the university, let's talk about Palo Alto's famous school, Stanford. It opened in 1891 by the aforementioned railroad tycoon, Leland Stanford. But by the early 1900s, the university is, to say the least, at a crossroads, and there's a battle royal over its future.
Yeah, so the first president of Stanford University, which it's important to note is named for not Leland Stanford Sr., but Leland Stanford Jr., who is the only child of Leland Stanford and Jane Stanford, who dies at a young age, very tragically. And as a response, they found this university that they dedicate to their child, and they get this first president from an institution called Indiana University, and his name is David Starr Jordan. And he and Jane Lathrop Stanford, who takes over the school after the death of her husband, have very different ideas of what the school should be used for. Jane thinks of it as a philosophical institution, you know, liberal arts, spiritualism even she was interested in, religious traditions and philosophy. And David Starr Jordan is a world-renowned eugenicist. He studies ichthyology himself. He studies fish biology. But he's really concerned with science and technology, mining engineering, psychology, the introduction of psychology and intelligence testing, and ultimately eugenics.
You know, we did a program years ago on how U.S. eugenicists were the inspiration for Hitler. So, you know, everything is connected.
Absolutely. Well, in German, this is even in the pre-Hitler period where German eugenicists and California eugenicists are collaborating and then find themselves in conflict as the Germans decide they're going to try and conquer the world, that those are the implications of eugenics.
So Starr Jordan's idea of science were based on white supremacy. He was a total 100% bigot.
Yeah, this is a man who was so racist, he was an anti-imperialist because he didn't want the Philippines, he didn't want Puerto Rico, he didn't want any of this territory and the non-white people in the American polity.
I'm talking to Malcolm Harris. Malcolm is a journalist and author, and his newie is Palo Alto, A History of California, Capitalism and the World, published by Little Brown and Co. Now, with no living heir to the university, it seems he would inherit its management if he could outlive Jane Stanford.
Yes. The only problem was she was frustrated with his conduct and was looking to fire him. And so the conflict between the two really reaches this peak. And at that moment, Jane Stanford is poisoned with strychnine. And she responds to this poisoning by fleeing the continent. She goes to Hawaii. And there in Hawaii, she's poisoned a second time, and she dies.
I'm sorry, she's poisoned twice?
She is poisoned twice with the same strychnine, with the same poison.
Is Starr David linked to her death?
Circumstantially. So there's a new book by the scholar Richard White called Who Killed Jane Stanford that dives into the history, and there's a strong circumstantial case that David Starr Jordan was involved in this plot to murder Jane Stanford, and he is definitely 100% involved in the cover-up, not only after the second poisoning, but he is already trying to cover up after the first poisoning. And so his behavior is extremely suspicious, but he's able to come out of this conflict smelling like roses.
And well, after the first poisoning, the story's put about that Jane Stanford was mad.
And David Starr Jordan is someone who really propagates this idea of Jane Stanford as someone who died from being a crazy old lady, even though he's not a medical doctor at all and has no expertise. He immediately sails to Hawaii and contests the autopsy and says that it must not have been poisoned, and impugns the conduct of the Hawaiian doctors. Which, again, very suspicious behavior as far as I'm concerned. But he was able to control the narrative for near 100 years afterward.
And he was able to control the management of the university and quickly turns it into a home for high-tech research and, quote, science, unquote.
Yeah, and eugenics in particular, Stanford becomes a real center of eugenics in the United States and even in the world under his management and into the 20th century.
Were there prominent opponents of eugenics at the time at other universities?
Yeah, absolutely. The idea was, every step of the idea was contested, not just by a figure like W.E.B. Du Bois, but by other scientists who, for example, when it came to intelligence testing, which was a real tool of the eugenicists, every step of the way, people questioned, what do you mean intelligence? How are you measuring this? This doesn't make any sense. You're begging the question with these tests. So every step of the way, there were questions about all this conduct, not just from the people who were designated inferior, who obviously knew they were not no such thing, but by people within the accepted white establishment.
The takeover marks the start of Stanford University's relationship with the emerging technology sector.
Yeah, in the radio age, way before silicon chips, personal computers, the internet, Stanford was still involved in the production of cutting-edge technology, starting with Federal Telegraph, which is a company that produced the first vacuum triodes, which is really the precursor to the transistor.
Now, Stanford's mining engineering graduates export the Californian model of resource exploitation to the rest of the world, Malcolm.
Absolutely, including and particularly Australia. And that comes through in large part through one of the members of the first class at Stanford University, who was a mining engineer, by the name of Herbert Hoover, who becomes later president of the United States.
And a visitor to our fair shores.
Australia. Yeah, absolutely. In what they called Westralia. Do they still call it Westralia?
No, it's now Western Australia.
I don't think so. Yeah, at the time, Westralia.
Don't tell Herbert, but we changed the name. So the first tech starter, backed by Stanford, was the Federal Telegraph Company in 1909. And that, as you say, completes the first radio transmission. And that was between California and, ominously perhaps, Hawaii.
Yeah, so the radio industry we might think of as a East Coast because you got Bell Labs or RCA, or in America, in the United States, it's commonly thought of as an East Coast phenomenon. But a lot of that development is really going on in these small startups around California. And when World War II starts, a lot of them get absorbed by larger conglomerates in the interest of national security. And this is still sort of a formative loss, I think, for the Silicon Valley tech community, even if they don't actually know that history themselves.
Our mutual friend Hoover, of course, gives his name to the Hoover Institute at Stanford, and we know that well as a think tank that's a very important part of the future Republican Party.
Yeah, one of the most important back rooms in the conservative political complex really is at Stanford University in Palo Alto, which is the Hoover Institution, which is a literal tower that towers over the town. It's the largest building in town. And it was created as this bulwark of anti-communism by Hoover, who really took the anti-colonial and left-wing revolts around the world personally. And they were personal for him. And since he owned a lot of interests and minds that were being reappropriated.
Is it still as influential as it was, Malcolm?
Yeah, the Hoover Institution is incredibly influential. If you look at U.S. COVID policy, for example, just recently, the Hoover Institution was really writing the right-wing briefs about how they were going to treat the disease. So it's very active right now, absolutely. But the right-wing complex around Hoover did even more than that. They built a much larger complex.
Malcolm, you argue that developments like the nuclear missile are fundamentally the product of Palo Alto.
Yeah, when people might think of the nuclear missile as this large metal object full of explosives, but in terms of its composition by value, so much of that is the cutting edge electronics and even the testing instruments that are used to create the electronics in the first place. And all of those are really coming out of the tech industry at that time. So the first generation of silicon chips all go into the Minuteman I nuclear missile. And that, more than anything, is the product of that defines Palo Alto in the 20th century.
Malcolm, you are persuading us that Palo Alto is a microcosm of all America. On the one hand, it's home to extreme wealth, but also it's a place of poverty. I didn't realize this. And just across the highway, East Palo Alto.
Yeah, and that highway itself, which is Highway 101 that runs through Palo Alto, is really a tool of what we call ghettoization, where it made the economic and racial division of town concrete, is what they, to use a pun, even though it had been illustrated through policy before that and what we called redlining, where neighborhoods were blocked off by race, the insertion of that highway, as it did in so many other American cities, ghettoized the population in East Palo Alto and split the town permanently in half.
No wonder it's sometimes called the concrete curtain. And amazingly, it doesn't even have a school.
Yeah, they destroyed the East Palo Alto school district such that the students who grew up there had to be bused to other school districts and not just sent, you know, across the highway to Palo Alto, where they live close enough, but distributed throughout the region.
So who lives in the ghetto? What's the ethnicity of its inhabitants?
So East Palo Alto begins as a black part of town, and over time you see Mexican and Central American immigrants, as well as Pacific Islanders, come to occupy it as well. So I think that's, it's now a minority black area, but still a strong minority.
Now, in the 1990s and 2000s, the devil's tool of the internet emerges. There's a promise from Silicon Valley that lives are going to get better, easier, fairer. That doesn't seem to have happened at all.
No, and if we think back to the late 90s or early 2000s, there was this promise that the efficiencies of information technology would mean that, you know, as consumers, we would get better things for less money faster. And instead, we might have gotten faster, but it's more money and worse things, I think, when you look around.
So the old structures of capitalism are replicated in these supposedly new economic systems, Malcolm.
Yeah, and the innovation that they keep coming up with is so often about the labor relation rather than any sort of technological, computer, whatever improvement. Instead, it's efficiencies derived through attacks on labor.
Heavens above. So, unsurprisingly, tech bosses have become obscenely rich, some of the richest people in the world, and they're exploiting disposable workers from factories in Asia to underpay Uber drivers.
That's a concise description, and it's because they control those networks and have set up those networks, that's what they're being rewarded for. Right? That's what capitalism wants them and needs them to do. And if someone else, if they didn't do it, someone else would. And that's what their argument is. But it's true. It's not because these people are extraordinarily capable. It's because they've agreed to fulfill this function for the market.
This very week on the program, we've been talking about how Silicon Valley seems to be imploding, workers laid off in their thousands, cryptocurrency crashing. And just last week, of course, famously, Silicon Valley Bank collapses with some sort of domino effect. How does all this fit into Palo Alto's history, Malcolm?
It's a pattern we see constantly throughout this whole history, which is a movement by one step back, two steps forward. And it doesn't really fit with our conventional narrativization where there's a rising and falling action and everyone learns their lesson from the crash and a bubble pops. Because if you look at the history, at the end of all these bubbles that are supposed to pop in Silicon Valley, people just keep getting richer, right? It keeps accumulating more. And so I think if we look a year or two down the line from now, the Silicon Valley bank collapse isn't going to be a hit to Silicon Valley. It's just going to be another one step backwards. They can take two steps forward.
It's still the same old theme of capitalize the profits, socialize the losses. But you point out the public sentiment towards the Valley has shifted quite dramatically.
It has. We're in a low point right now, it seems like. But again, these are constant cycles. So in the late 90s, there was a movie called Antitrust that more or less depicted Bill Gates as a serial killer. And, you know, 20 years before that, the left wing was bombing electronics executives' homes. So we see these cycles for sure. But over time, the figure of the tech entrepreneur has become much more prominent, has acquired more authority over time. And that's where I see the trend line going.
But of course, people are now aware that companies like Facebook have exploited consumer data and allowed misinformation to thrive. So consequently, these companies played a part in the rise and rise of Trump.
It's true. And yet they persist. And there haven't been many consequences. You know, we had the Snowden revelations were major. It revealed a real dangerous system that was acquiring data about people in the United States that the government would not be otherwise entitled to get without a warrant. And yet we haven't seen any reform or change of that system since.
Malcolm, you conclude your book Back at Stanford with the suggestion that the university should return the land it sits on to the indigenous people we were talking about before, the Ohlone. Do you think there's a snowball's chance that that would ever happen?
You know, I don't think that they are able to, within their structures, return all 8,000 acres or all $30 billion of the endowment. However, in terms of a step that the university could take, the Muwekmo Ohlone are a politically constituted tribal organization that the school recognizes. We're talking about a little over 600 people who have confirmed genetic relation to remains from thousands of years ago from that place. They can draw their ancestry very clearly. And so Stanford has an opportunity to at least start moving in a direction of repair by ceding some of that land back and ceding some of those resources back. So I do think there's a chance.
You make the point that Stanford owns 8,000 hectares of land that have not been sold and are not being used. Perhaps they could start there.
Yeah, I mean, some of it's being used, obviously, but if you or the listeners have ever been to Stanford University campus, it's huge and very nice land, and they own throughout the peninsula, throughout the Bay Area, a ton of land. So they've definitely got plenty that they could start seeding if they wanted to, as well as a counterparty that they can start seeding the land to, not just in a general way to indigenous people, but to a tribe that they recognize has an ancestral claim to the area.
As the unofficial biographer of Palo Alto, you clearly see it as the core of American history.
At least modern American history, yeah, it really is. At the beginning, I was surprised just how much material I was really finding and how central it ends up being to this second period of American history.
Malcolm, you've been a fascinating guest with an extraordinary tale to tell, and we thank you for it. My guest has been Malcolm Harris, journalist and author extraordinaire. The book, his latest, Palo Alto, A History of California, Capitalism and the World.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.